Welcome to Esoteric Modulation, episode 19, For the Love of the Magnetique. Esoteric Modulation is your podcast that covers all the wild and wonderful world of modular, exciting and unusual instruments, guest interviews, sound snippets, and we also take a look into the interesting sound and visual art projects too. I'm Ben Wilson.
And I'm Ed Ball. Hang on, Ben, you just did a quick switch on me there, didn't you? It's like a sleight of hand.
Everyone must have thought you were ill. Why is he letting this lad do this intro? What's going on?
Nice your dulcet tones, mate. They always go well. And I have to say, Ben, you've been on fire, actually, haven't you? Because you've just done all the super boob stuff. So I thought, well, you know what? Just let the man run with it. He's on a roll. The single malt stuff that you did with Heimbach was just brilliant. I really like that format. Did you enjoy doing that?
Yeah, really liked it. Very much credit to Heimbach and Constantine for that. That was their idea and me brought in as a kind of full-time honorary guest, if you like, the spare third wheel in the boot. But no, their idea was to capture the vibe and essence of Superboof, bump into friends, artists that you respect and admire and all these things, and come and check this out. And you go check a booth out, you discuss other people's gear with other builders, and he was very much trying to capture that chaos in what turned out to be not a very chaotic way to do it. I thought it was going to be total chaos, this idea of one long live stream that lots and lots of people call in with a schedule. I think, God, we're not going to keep to that schedule. The tech's not going to hold up. Yeah. But it did a really good job. For anyone curious, we were using StreamYard, which other than being mono, which is its only downside.
Mono in the case of everyone's got stereo filters to show
yeah,
off.
Yeah, this year was the stereo filter year, so we couldn't get any of that. But I did speak to StreamYard and they said they're looking into it. We'll pass the feedback on. But nice. Very, very good. And I know that B-Boy Tech and streams from friends over in the States are using that too. So yeah. For anyone curious in the technology, that's StreamYard. But yeah, I kind of rolled off of that into Sonic Talk with Nick, Mr. PWM.
Have a good show.
Yeah, and that really, I'm not on fire anymore because that just kind of, you know, recess into the back of the seat kind of
thing.
I think
it was exhausted after that, wasn't you?
Yeah.
That's pretty much go, 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 wasn't it?
Yeah, by day two of these live streams, I felt like the real super booth. And I did send him back a message saying, you've done it, because I'm absolutely as tired as a real day at super booth. I'm knackered.
It's a realistic environment.
Yeah, but without, you know, 55, 60 videos to edit as soon as you get home. So there was that angle that was nice. But no, it was really, really good. And the community was out in absolute force to kind of absorb and engage and take part. It was a really amazing experience.
Yeah, it was brilliant. I really enjoyed it. There's some great content out there, to be fair. But I really did enjoy that live stream, the single malt live stream, because I think it did give a little bit of a flavour of Superboof. And it was very smooth, considering you're having to line all those people up in the background of that software and bring them in. And then, you know, change over to cameras. Really good. I was really impressed with that. So besides that, mate, what you been up to?
Bit of a spending spree, some bargains, some disappointments, shall we say, expensive disappointments. Yeah, I picked up, we won't dwell on it for too long, but a quick and dirty kind of analog BBD delay from Ira. And there's a little bit of audio that I wanted to share from that.
I love this because it's got a dirty richness, hasn't it? And when I first listened to it, I said, what was you putting through that? That's how much it affected the instrument. But it was a guitar, wasn't it?
Yeah, guitar. Just fading the volume up and down just to take all the front end off. It does smear it into the sound of something else. And you can just hear that clock whine where the BBD's been pushed a little bit too long, which is...
Yeah.
Well, they usually filter that out. I'm surprised I found that. Older analog BBDs tend to be quite dull to get rid of all that top end. But but beyond that, another absolute bargain, a Kilpatrick Fennel.
Oh, I fancied one of these.
Yeah, and this is my first patch for us to listen to in a second, but very Surge-esque, Seat Lombard-esque. There's a really kind of dirty, crunchy delay. Nice stereo image, a bit like how you can split out sounds on a plum butter. So yeah, let's listen to that.
You know what? I've seen this quite a time ago now, and I really like the look of it. You know, it's banana. It's you know, I like the idea of these guys that produce these type of all-in-one synths that you get a flavour for what they want it to sound like. And I think the Thenal, to me, has got a sound. You can definitely tell it's got a sound. Obviously, it covers a wide range, I know that. But a bit like a Buchla, you can sort of tell on certain patches it's a Buchla. Mm. I think you can tell on the Thenal. It's got some wicked bass on the thing.
Yeah, kind of rubbery cleanness in a weird way. I guess a Buchla can get rubbery. Descriptors are always debatable and people take them differently because it's subjective. But yeah, it's definitely got a sound of its own. When I saw one come up very cheap, I wasn't going to let it go. How about you? You've been playing with some new gear as well.
Yeah, well, I had the OM1 come and land on my desk, which was fantastic. And unfortunately, I've been super busy, so I haven't had a massive amount of time to go through it. So I'm just getting to grips with it at the moment. But yeah, it's been a great experience to start learning the instrument in a way that it's very different to anything else that I've played, to be fair. The sounds from it are just great, really beautifully warm, lo-fi, saturated, and I've had some real good fun with it. I've put some audio together. I saw what I did was, in fact, you give me the deadline, actually. That's probably what. You know what? I need you to give me deadlines, because when you give me a deadline, I actually go and do stuff, you know, because you said, get a sound sample for the show. And I was like, okay, then. I think you can get around about 7 cassettes with it, and I've got 4 of those. So I just use the sounds from there. I haven't recorded any of my own sounds yet. But the thing that I did think about when I started playing with it is, boy, this thing wants to go into effects, because it's got that characteristic that you know is just going to catch reverb beautifully, give you good echoes. So the audio I got over to you, Ben, was basically the OM1 put through the Eventide Space, which is my stock standard.
It's a nice pairing.
Yeah, really nice pairing. So yeah, I enjoyed that.
Great. Well, let's hear it. So you sent this audio over pretty much a few hours after the Echoplex arrived, that I've spoke about maybe on this show, certainly in a few other places. I had a lovely little honeymoon period of a couple of hours getting this quirky old machine. It was a pre-Maestro, when it was Market Electronics EP3, for any kind of connoisseurs of the tape world or tape echo world. But once I kind of coaxed it back into life, which, you know, nothing internal, just playing around effectively. Had a glorious couple of hours with the Echoplex the day before we're recording today, and then went to run your audio through it as a kind of, Ed's had got an OM1, I've got an Echoplex, let's smash them together. Yeah. And it's died. I woke up the morning after and the pillow next to me was empty, as it were. It's the Echoplex has gone. She's gone. She's left. It's only a fleeting thing of the night. But as a bit of a consolation prize, I thought we'd kick out the Space Echo, not to disappoint you too much that you can't have your audio through a tape echo. So here's a couple of little hits from your OM1 through the Roland RE201. And then, of course, once I'd got the Space Echo out, I couldn't help but run a little arpeggiated kind of sequence through it. So I thought I'd share just one little bit more of audio, just highlighting a few of the sounds on the 201, which is a very simple modular pattern, just coming straight in. ¶¶ So that was the spring reverb, just fading up and down, and then this is the tape echo level and feedback, then fading up. Final kind of flurry of effects, this is bringing in both the spring and the delay and the feedback and increasing the level of all of them towards the kind of sludgy time modulated section at the end.
Yeah, it always amazes me that just a simple, beautiful, plunky, spatial sound put through a great echo just sounds brilliant, doesn't it?
I think it's why we're all delay junkies and we end up with loads of them. And it's fine. It's like people, you know, filter junkies on analog synths and in modular, where you kind of tell yourself you need one of every filter topology and flavor. I think it's very easy to do that with tape machines and with different delay technologies. I definitely get caught up in that. Oh, but that one's just a bit more saturated and that one's a bit of a longer delay time, but it's cleaner. And I, you know, we all make excuses and validate these objects.
Yes.
Being in the room, but the 201 does a great job. Really lovely sound to it.
Yeah, it's a really lovely sound, isn't it? You just cannot beat a good echo, can you? It's just fantastic. So on this week's show, we have a musician, sound designer, instrument maker, and graphic designer based in New Orleans, LA. It all started out with him circuit bending in the 90s. From that, he started to build circuits, which later led him down the path to producing his own very unique instrument. His graphic designs are often used in conjunction with his music output, which has been released on many labels, including Seal Records. Known for his wonderful tape-based instrument, his creation can put oodles of charm, character, warmth, and warble into any recording. The instrument is the OM1, and our guest this week is Scott Campbell. Hey, Scott, how you doing?
Hey, nice to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, well, thanks for coming on. It's brilliant we have a new when I've just got to use the OM1. So it's sort of nice to be able to talk about that and talk to the maker of the OM1 too. Before we dig into the OM1, I think it'd be really nice just for you to talk through your history. I mean, it's hard, isn't it? Because when you're a multi-creative, all these different strands tend to blend into each other at different times. But if you could just walk us through early circuit bending, how graphic design played a part and how it all come to be now and the build up to building the OM1. So could you just take us a little bit back in time to where we are now?
It all started, I guess, when I was 15 or so, started playing bass, doing the band thing, and at the same time learning how to record on a 4-track. So I guess my love for tape started pretty early. So that was my teenage years. And then when I got to early 20s, late teens, I got into more sample-based music. So I started wanting more interesting sounds to add to my music. And the whole circuit bending thing started to bubble up on the internet. And this is, you know, early 2000s. So we're talking pretty archaic internet days. But there were, you know, little things here and there about circuit bending, and it seemed weird. And what drew me to that, I guess, was the same thing that drew me to electric music in general, was just, you know, hearing things like Aphex Twin or Boards of Canada or whatever. It was like, I didn't understand how any of it was being made. I didn't know how these sounds were being created, how the music was being put together, none of it. So when I started to get into a more sample-based workflow, you know, I started with the crate digging thing and would go to the thrift store, buy weird records, cut them up, put them into Acid Pro on my computer and make these loop compositions. And eventually I wanted to start getting into, you know, synthesizers and that sort of thing, but without money to really spend on those pieces of equipment. I could go to the same thrift store, buy these weird toys, old speaking spells and other odds and ends, and get weird sounds out of them, and then sample those and use that as sample fodder to cut up and make weird compositions. And then eventually I bought a Moog MG1 that was like the cheap entry-level synth that everyone had back then. And I loved it. Once again, you get on the internet and you read about how you can mod it to have a filter input, so you can run things through the filter. So I learned how to do that. And that sort of sparked more of like a modification, circuit modification interest, aside from the circuit bending thing, which is sort of chaotic and noise based. The more modification end of that world, the results can be more musical because you're using actual pieces of musical equipment instead of children's toys. So, you know, I got into that, and I got into repairing synths too, because at that time, this is before the big boom where, you know, all these companies are putting out all these beautiful analog synthesizers like they do now. Like back then, it was just vintage equipment, and most of the time they were broken. And when they were broken, you could get them for much cheaper too. So, you know, learning how to fix equipment, learning about circuitry that way, and breaking a lot of things, and that's part of the process. And then eventually I cobbled together enough equipment to start like playing live and doing little shows. And in the South in early 2000s, people were not really interested in that. So I played a lot of shows to a lot of people that weren't super interested. But what I did realize is that instead of doing like the dive bar route, if I went more like the art gallery route and played art shows, it had a much better reception. And luckily at the time I had a lot, or still do have a lot of friends who are in that world. You know, in my 20s, I did a lot of gallery shows with these weird toy setups and synthesizers. And I had a cheap little Akai S20, which is like the most basic sampler you could ever have. But it was nice to load up with weird circuit bent samples and that sort of stuff. And then around that same time, my early 20s, I guess, I stumbled upon a guy named Mike Walters, who does homemade instruments under the name Mystery Circuits. I don't know if he's still doing that, but he had built this thing called the Mellow Man, which was basically a Mellotron built out of about 16 Walkmans, stereo Walkmans. And then you had a note on each side of the stereo, you know, each track on the stereo tape. So that gave you 32 notes. It was labor intensive, but you could record whatever you wanted on those tapes and have a Mellotron, basically. And so I started buying Walkmans, and I was going to make one of those. And I had this nice old enclosure. It was sort of like that Vox Continental looking keyboard that someone had given me that was totally trash, but I could use the enclosure and the keys and all that. Had everything ready to go, and then I ended up having to move out of state, so I pretty much abandoned all that. So throughout my 20s, I played drums too in a lot of bands, so that sort of took over, and I was doing that for, you know, about 10 years. And then in my early 30s, I really started getting back into electronic music again. And, you know, it's that same desire to have sounds that no one else has. So I started wanting to build instruments to create my own sounds and that sort of thing. And I've always had a love of tape, so I wanted to revisit that idea and just started playing around with things, and eventually happened upon this little, you know, pitch controllable monophonic Mellotron, if you will, or whatever. You know, a few years later, I built a little prototype, and then you got Instagram. So I post a little clip on Instagram, and people want one. So, and the rest is history, you know. So I honed it, you know, honed the design, made it look really nice. And like you said, I'm a graphic designer, so the aesthetic was definitely really important. I mean, let's be honest, that's a big part of why we all like synthesizers so much, is because of how amazing they look. So yeah, and the tape thing is still goes on today. I'm still, you know, buying up weird tape players when I find them, and I love those Marantz tape decks, the three head decks, and build echoes out of those for people all the time. I have four sitting behind me right now. And I just love it. And it's just like, it's nice. The internet has really like changed my outlook on the whole being an electronic musician thing, because where I'm located, it's not a huge scene. I definitely have friends that do it around here, but there's not a lot of people you can like relate to on this weird hobby or whatever. And having the internet and being able to connect with all these people and see that they're interested in what I'm doing and the things I'm making, it's just nice to be able to have these things that I've made for myself be so desirable for other people. And then I get to hear what they make with them. And that's just more fuel for my fire to just keep doing things and making weird things for people.
Yeah, we live in a totally different world now, don't we, Scott? I mean, I think for what we do, the advent of the internet and people being able to build tribes within that, and just being able to drill down into things that you love and listen to that and watch that, rather than you have to watch mass TV or listen to mass radio, which, you know, is boring. You can drill down into these really niche things that you do and enjoy other people's take on them. It's just a magic time for that, isn't it?
Yeah, it's really taken the whole, I mean, it used to be like a local scene sort of deal, which is a little bit of a shame that that's not so much of a thing anymore. But those local scenes have sort of become internet scenes, where those like-minded people, you know, find each other that way. And, you know, for me, it's nice, because I'm in an area where I wasn't really having those peer groups in the numbers that I would appreciate. But yeah, it's definitely, I think it's a plus ultimately.
Yeah, it is. It's a definite plus. I mean, I absolutely love it. To take it back to the O-in-1 though, I mean, it's a great instrument. I've had real fun with it over the last few days. So what was it about sort of this tape-based mechanism that connected with you and you thought, yeah, I really want to do something like that? Was it just, you know, was it the mechanical aspect of it? Was it the sound? Was it both?
Yeah, I think it's a little bit of everything. Just like, you know, I'm a big hardware guy. The thing about hardware is the happy accidents and the weirdness and the things that you don't plan for. And tape is great at handing you those things for better or worse. You know, tape is going to impart what used to be considered errors, wow and flutter, that sort of thing. But in the digital age, we have obviously come to love those things. And those things are what make it seem organic. And so, you know, just being able to use those, kind of bend them to your will a little bit and have a little control over them in a musical context has always been interesting to me. And like I said, you know, like growing up with tapes and tape recorders, and it was always something that I had incorporated in my music. So it was just, it's really natural, I guess, that it happened.
Yeah, I've just got up a picture of the Mystery Circuits Mellow Man. Did you get to use that at all?
No. I just had seen, you know, videos and audio clips, but
it looks, doesn't it, like some sort of funky 70s scene that you would have seen in the back of the Dukes of Hazzard car.
Exactly. And that's another thing. It's like the aesthetic, you know, the aesthetic is a huge part of it. It's like, not only is it cool and like the idea is cool, but when you look at it before even knowing what it is, you're like, I want to know what that is.
Almost there's a little bit of mystery to something like your building and, you know, the Mellow Man. It's just, there's a little bit of sort of secret sauce in there with the sound. Because what struck me is when I very first heard the sound, this haunting sort of moving sound, that's what pretty much brought me into it. And I just thought, wow, that sounds amazing. And having grabbed it now and obviously got it, it does sound amazing. But I have to say, there is a playing skill to it, Scott. It's what I would say is, I would class it as an instrument. It's like you have definitely got to have this sort of articulation between your left and right hand to get all these subtle little gestures out of it. And this is what I find really interesting. I can't do this naturally yet. Obviously, the more time I'll get on it, I will have it. But when I slowly start mixing the different gestures from your left hand, which is, you know, producing the volume, the gate, if you like, and the actual right hand that's obviously doing all the melodic stuff. There's this interplay, isn't there, between hitting it just before, just after, letting it ride, so you sort of hear a faint note.
Right.
It's not the easiest instrument to just get and play, but a bit like a guitar, it's going to actually give you a lot of reward, I think, because you can get these different forms of sound articulations from it. I mean, is that just something that naturally comes with this type of, you know, instrument, or is it a thing that you've put thought into and sort of created it to be like this?
I mean, I definitely have considered that in the design. You know, should I just make it keys that make a sound when you press the keys like any other keyboard? And, you know, that would be okay, but the whole concept behind it was to be a little bit more like the own Martineau, in the way you can articulate notes with one hand and then choose a pitch with the other hand.
Yeah.
And like you said, I think that makes it more like an instrument in its own right, and not just like a keyboard that plays tape samples, sort of a vibe. But like you said, I would hope that it would be a little rewarding when you spend some time with it, which I think you should do with any instrument. So,
Yeah, I mean, me and Ben talk about this regularly, and it's just the thing that people want to get instant gratification.
Yeah.
And actually, in years gone by, you would not be able to do that. And I'm used to it. I mean, it's like the continuum. I mean, okay, you can press a note, it makes a nice sound. But to really get the best out of that, there's a playing technique behind that, because very similar to the 0-in-1, you know, your finger is the actual envelope, if you like.
Mm-hmm.
So there is a learning curve with that, as well as there is with this. But I think within that learning curve, you can go into all the nooks and crannies of different gestures that you can play with it, which gives it, I think, in the long term, a lot more character and, you know, a sense of you conquering and learning that instrument too.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And just being able to, like, the touch pad on it, like, I've had people be like, well, if I press it, it doesn't do an envelope, or it doesn't, you know, give me an attack. And I have to explain to them, it's really about pressure. You have to really, like, be in tune with what you're doing. You can't just tap it like you would a key on a keyboard. You have to understand how you're applying pressure to it in order to create that envelope. And I think that really helps you, like, get in tune with what you're doing and not just kind of like bang something out.
I think the ultimate reward, it comes from putting that time and effort in. As a teenager, I used to really look at kind of virtuoso guitar players and all that kind of thing. I think a lot of us went through that phase on different instruments. But I love that there may be this, like, one killer OM1 player out there that's just nailed it.
Yeah.
And I don't mean like they're shredding solos on the thing. But
Jimi Hendrix.
The Hendrix of the OM1. But just that there's just someone, in the same way as Hendrix, are that, you know, stylistically different, but they are kind of one with that instrument. And that's maybe a little gushy or romantic, but this idea that time has been spent to just be completely fluid, flow state, at one with the technology. I mean, you couldn't drop a modular case in front of someone and say, make a cool patch. You know, you couldn't pick a guitar up and play a chord if you'd never played it before. So I like that there's this instant response of, ooh, cool, tape. And that just has a sound. It sounds glorious, all the bits I've heard from the OM1 and Ed's piece earlier as well. It's interesting thinking of pitch having to modulate tape speed as well, because it can't be instant. This conversation came up around the motor synth that's from Game Changer Audio. It's, again, a very different product, but the fact it's using drone motors that spin at audible rates, it can't instantly move from one pitch to another. So however they work that technology, there has to be this kind of slewing of pitch and time. And I like that being kind of part of the OM1 as well, that tape can't jump an octave in pitch up double speed at the absolute click of a finger. Now, it's not slow, but it's not like pressing the key on a keyboard. And I like that, again, it just puts you in this place and you have to find this balance and find yourself in the instrument. Anything that does that kind of grabs my attention. It's a really interesting thing.
Having that little bit of lag, it's reminding you that it's tape, you know what I mean? It's reminding you that it's a physical thing that's moving in there. And I choose a tape player that gives me probably the least amount of lag or portamento, however you want to say it, as possible. But it's still nice to have just that little slight rise and fall when you switch notes. I mean, it's tape, and you want those tape characteristics to come through.
I wanted to ask you the OM1. Any favorite kind of pairings for it? Do you find a certain effect or piece that you really like to run it through?
I'm a big fan of Frippertronics and those Frippino records. And just like, I think I have a YouTube piece actually of just me playing the OM1 into a Strymon Magneto loop, like not a delay, but like a longer loop, sound on sound. And it's just like layering on top of, you know, past recordings, because it's a mono instrument, so it's nice to be able to layer up notes like that through the sound on sound loop. And I think that's probably my favorite thing to pair it with. And then of course reverbs, man. I mean, you know, any reverb you can put on it, it's gonna sound good.
That was when Ed said, oh, I'm gonna send all these through the space, because when I thought the Echoplex was still going to be working, I said, oh, if you're doing it through space, you'll be stereo reverbs. I'll collapse it to mono and run it through the tape echo. But as Ed said right at the start, it pushes through the kind of smog of a big reverb from everything I've heard with the OM1. Its character still shines through. I think you can very easily kind of bog down anything in a big reverberant wash that turns to mush.
Yeah.
For you, Ed, with that first piece you played us at the start, what kind of dry wet were you on that? Because it sounds spacious, which...
Yeah.
I'm curious how much of that was the space and how much of that do you put down to just the character and sounds on those tapes?
Yeah, on most of it, I kept it really low, actually, because I was on some big reverbs, like the sort of black hole reverbs and that type of thing. So about 25-30%, most of them, because they're big cavernous reverbs, and if it went all wet on that, it'd just get lost. Mm. Depending on the reverb, really, like you said, it does have this unique sound that sort of pushes through quite nicely. But also catches those reverbs really nicely as well. Because I think, you know, sort of tape-based sounds catch the reverbs really nicely. For me anyway, because I love those sort of dark, creamy tones going through a reverb. Especially when the reverb's, you know, a bit high-end as well. Mm-hmm. It tends to sort of balance it. But yeah, the character does still come through, doesn't it?
Yeah, there's this kind of three-dimensionalness to it, which is weird because it's this monophonic in a stereo sense and monophonic in a single pitch sense. I was playing around with a project. You sent me a project and not just the audio. It only takes two or three layers with a little bit of panning for it to start to really feel like there's a big kind of spacious thing going on. And I can hear that in your music, Scott. There's this character, I don't know, this spaciousness without being kind of drenched and totally wet in effect. Is that something you've kind of fallen into over the years? Is that something you really work at? I think you've got a real sense of space. Yeah. And I don't mean huge cavernous reverb, but it feels like a physical thing you've captured within your music.
Yeah, it's really nice to hear you say that, actually, because that's definitely something that I've taken into consideration more and more, especially over the past year or two and on the last record I put out. And like you said, it's more about stereo feel and width and not necessarily about reverb. And one of the little tricks that I like to do now too is incorporate field recordings, stereo field recordings, because even if it's just some sort of like bed, some background thing that you add into a track that pops up every now and then, you don't always hear it. It just adds a sense of atmosphere and a sense of space that you can't really fake it. You kind of have to actually capture that space or, you know, capture something in the place where it happens. You know, you can't really like put a plug in on something to make it sound that way. But I do take a lot of care to like position things in the stereo field in post. Like I don't do a lot of post work, usually just EQ and then some like stereo positioning sort of stuff. So yeah, I'm glad you noticed.
And it's really weird, isn't it? Because we all get the promos for the MPCs and the 707s and or deluges and all that type of stuff. And you get this certain genre of music and you just forget that you can produce anything with anything, because listening to that soundscape that you put together on the 707, I'll close my eyes. It could have been tape based.
Yeah.
So it's amazing how you can go through all these different instruments and still have this lovely, rich, tape-based feel that has definitely got your sonic fingerprint on. What are some of the sort of bits of instruments that you like working with that you think, yeah, I really love working with that. That really talks to me in a way.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I guess the 707 is definitely something I'm really focused on right now. I always liked samplers because, you know, people can look at those 707 demos or whatever and think, oh, well, this is like a preset dance machine. Well, my response is it's a sampler. It's whatever you want it to be. So like you say that, you know, you close your eyes and it sounds like tape. Well, that's because I recorded sounds through tape into the 707 and then used those as like an oscillator for a synthesizer, basically. And beyond that, that machine, one of my old secret weapons was the Roland JV2080, which is a 90s era rack rompler that doesn't get a lot of love for most people, but and the people that know about it know how powerful it is. And I was one of those people and really learned how to program it. So when I saw the 707 and I looked at the manual and I looked at like the synth architecture, it's pretty much the same synthesis engine as the 2080 in this nice little, you know, groove box thing with the scale pads and all that. So it was kind of a no-brainer for me. You combine the sampling with that. It's so much you can do with it. It's really open-ended. And really, a lot of my workflow now has revolved around samplers, loopers, and granular synthesis. Like the Tasty Chips GR1 is a big thing that I like to use now. It's, you know, there's a lot of software that can do that sort of thing, like Quanta, Borderlands. There's a lot of stuff on iPad, actually. But I try to get away from screens and software as much as possible. So that GR1 is really the only game in town in terms of like really high-end granular hardware. And it's beautiful. I mean, it sounds amazing. And there's a lot you can do with it. It's four-part multi-timbral. And then, of course, the ER-301, the granular units on that are pretty amazing in a different way. Like, it's not quite the same thing as the GR-1. But that's nice because you can set up a looper buffer and, you know, share that between granular units and other players. And the ER-301 is like my dream machine because, I mean, they say it's a modular within a modular, and that's pretty true because it's what drew me to modular in the first place is that it lets you bring your ideas to fruition. And, you know, you get an idea of something you want to create, an effect or a chain, and you can literally do it. And the ER-301 lets you do that all in one device. So yeah, I've kind of been focused on 301, that Tasty Chips,
and the 707.
Tape machines, and the 707. I mean, I've been recording new material, and it's sort of revolved around those pieces of gear. And my modular has sort of dwindled down into a condensed setup that's based around the 301. A couple of other things too, but I don't know. I just like that focused approach to modular these days, I guess.
It's interesting. We've spoke to a couple of people who, you know, love their tape, and they seem to be drawn towards the ER-301, quite a few of them. I've sort of drawn a line and thought, oh, this looks like it's got a massive learning curve on it. It looks like a menu diving sort of stuff that I want to sort of get away with. But the more and more I hear people wax lyrical about the 301, the more and more I think, that's sort of worth a look at, that is.
It is. And, you know, I tend to, and the 707 is the same way, and any like really deep piece of gear. I mean, I love immediate gear too. You know, I have a Vermona Performer, which is, you know, this giant thing full of knobs that there's zero programming involved. You know, it's just knobs twiddling. But something like the 301, I tend to take an approach where I don't sit down and think I'm going to build something in it and make music. You know, I'll take a session or an afternoon or whatever where I'm just kind of building out some ideas in it, and you can save those, and then they're there to use whenever. And then later on, I'll, you know, another session, I'll just open that up and make something with it. And there's no menu diving when you do, when you've already made it, right? So it's easier to, you know, be creative that way, because I don't want to spend a lot of time menu diving before I'm trying to be creative either, you know?
Yeah, it's like tidying the studio the day before you know you've got time in the studio.
Exactly.
It's kind of enabling these things to happen. I know lots of stories of musicians over the years doing similar things. Like, I think Liam Howlett from The Prodigy used to talk about sampling Sundays,
mm-hmm.
that they didn't want to be in the moment of music making and digging records at the same time as building a library or kind of building your own assets and things for certain projects, so that everything is to hand and immediate. So I can see that a few afternoons spent, once you're comfortable with the 301, kind of building what you want for a given project or album, a certain granular looper or something like that, that you then just sit and live with and use for a while. And then, you know, an afternoon later, you kind of morph that into another piece of gear.
Yeah, I think that's the sort of thing that I need to do too, is just try and segregate my time between playing and actually setups and deep diving into it, because there's still lots more that I need to look at with deep diving into, say, the Continuum, because that sound engine is absolutely huge.
Oh, yeah.
And I always think, I'll get a day and go into that. And I know I can get a lot out of it if I do, and I don't tend to do that. So I think I'm going to start doing that, sort of marking days for music and days for sort of technology and, you know, putting together the basis of that that can improve your music.
That way you're not using both sides of your brain in the same session. It's a lot to ask of yourself, I feel like.
Yeah, I think it is, isn't it? It's definitely, the creative side is definitely different to that sort of side that's trying to be logic and trying to sort things out technically. I even find it hard to flip over within a day doing that. Mm-hmm. You know, if I'm doing something, I always find if I'm going to do something creative, I could do with doing that first thing in the morning without burning my brains out with the logic side of things, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
I'd like to move on from the gear journey to the actual music journey and, sure. you know, where you've gone through that. And again, you've had this sonic fingerprint that's ran through all those. But I'd just like to talk first off about your first musical release, because I think that's a nice one to start, because that's where you've coerced your sort of artistic and graphical knowledge and brought that together with audio and something very tangible, very analog. It's got a lot of feeling to it. And going through all the assets that I can see of that project, it looks like it was a wonderful project.
Thanks.
To start, if you like, your musical career off.
Sure,
with.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about that, how it came about, what happened, what sort of equipment you've been using, and how you thought of bringing the artistic design side into it too?
That music was really around the time that I had just gotten into modular and started to go down that rabbit hole. So I had started to amass, you know, recordings, and at the same time started posting little clips on Instagram. The beauty of the internet, Benjamin Wynn, who plays under the name Deru, who I was a huge fan of, has a small label that he co-runs called 79 Ancestors. He saw some of my Instagram clips and asked me if I had music I wanted to release. So it sort of was like, you know, great timing. I had a lot of recordings I had been working on that really had started from when I started with the Eurorack journey, and, you know, had that cohesive vibe because they all were around the same time when I was getting to know the modular and figuring things out and all that. And so that's basically how the music end of it came together. And the visual thing, around that same time, I think this was 2016, my parents' house flooded, like really bad flood, like once in a millennium sort of crazy flood happened. During the aftermath of that, I was tasked with going through some of the waterlogged photo albums. And it's just this crazy rush of emotions of like seeing your parents and these photos of like your parents in their 20s and these crazy photos you've never seen in your life of your family's history, but they're all destroyed and like water damaged in these weird, gross, but beautiful ways. So it was just like, you know, this coming together of these emotions because of the situation with just the beauty of these destroyed photos. And I wanted to capture that, and I wasn't able to use any of the actual photos, unfortunately, just because they were so destroyed. But what I ended up doing was taking my own Polaroids and figuring out ways to destroy them with water and other methods, and creating these abstract yet recognizable images that were basically an homage to that situation. And it all tied in with like the sort of melancholy vibe of the music really well. And there's also a little bit of hope, I feel like, especially towards the end of that record, because
yeah,
that's sort of like ties into my family's disposition. There's a lot of hard, you know, feelings going through that, but ultimately it was hopeful in the end. So hopefully that's conveyed somewhat in the music, but
I think that sums it up absolutely beautifully in the way that when I looked at this and listened to it, is that I would say it's like solemn and haunting and ghostly in parts. And then it starts to emerge a bit like spring comes out.
Yeah.
And sort of the mood lightens towards the end.
Nice.
A very, very beautiful video that was shot to this. Can you talk about that?
Yeah.
It's so organic, so analog, so beautiful.
That was done by Sean Curtis Patrick, who is also a great musician, as well as an amazing, you know, video artist. Like, he's done a lot of video work for himself, for Richard Devine, for Banna Hafar. He's done video work for them and was nice enough to do this for us. And he's done a lot of work with Polaroids already, so it was sort of a perfect fit. And he did just a lot of amazing like analog manipulation of Polaroids and inks and paints with these amazing camera techniques, which I don't know much about because that's not my world, but I know that the end result was just like this beautiful thing that tied in perfectly with what we were trying to capture with that whole release.
Yeah, I mean, it does totally, because I've, you know, got some images of your booklet photo from the flood that accompanied the music.
Yeah.
And the beautiful Polaroids in there where they've obviously, you know, got wet and there's been this chemical reaction of colors.
Mm-hmm.
And I always find there's a beauty in decay, and there's this absolute beauty in those Polaroids.
Yeah.
And then you flick to the video, and the video is just a analog of that. It is.
Yeah, it's an extension, like perfectly captured. Yeah, we were so happy with it.
Just absolutely beautiful. So I'm guessing you were really happy with the output of that first, I suppose we'd call it an art project.
Yeah, I mean, and that's kind of the whole idea behind 79 Ancestors, is to sort of release these, not just a record, but a complete like art piece. And that's, they don't put out a lot, but when they do, that's, you know, it's quality, which was, you know, I was honored to be able to do something with them. So that was the whole goal, really, was to make this cohesive big piece of art that all ties in together visually and sonically.
It's interesting you mentioned this, that we like kind of living in or are attracted in some way to degradation. And I think that rings us kind of back into the audio side of the tape. That's what we like.
Yeah.
I love living in feedback loops, tape. Really interestingly, saw Paul Barker of DinSync, just another kind of side note, found a, there's a little Chinese kind of vinyl cutter player for $99.
I saw him posting about that.
Yeah. And people going, oh God, it's going to sound horrible. But then people coming in to kind of add to that to say, in a really good way, yeah. Everton. I hope this is just like ultra lo-fi chaos, just mess and sludge. And it seems to be. We'll find some things to link in the show notes from that. It looks like an interesting process.
For sure.
To actually cut your own plastic records that probably don't last very long. I imagine you need to have everything on record all the time.
Yeah.
I wanted to speak about your album on Sale Records, Stillness. Mm-hmm. One of the questions rings back to what we were talking about earlier about the sense of space in the music. And a few questions in my notes, but to start with, I just wanted to talk about how much of the album was created outdoors. It feels like there's loads of outside influence, outside space. Again, I'm not sure exactly what that space is.
Yeah.
Woodland, open space, field. It feels very outdoors and spacious. How much of it was recorded outside? And would you put that down to the addition of Foley that creates that image? Is it a very conscious thing you've tried to create?
Yeah, I think it's definitely that's the field recording aspect that I have been trying to incorporate. You know, I just got one of those Zoom H6s that everyone has, and I have a little stereo Sony cassette handheld recorder. And it was just, you know, when it's raining outside and there are frogs croaking, I was like, hey, I'll just record this, you know, and those little instances where I happened to hear something, there was, you know, there's a metal fence on the side of my house and like a branch was tapping on it, creating a pitch. So I went outside and recorded that and just, you know, leaves crunching, all these little things that they're not the focal point in any of the tracks. But like you said, they add a sense of space that you can't really like fake. It has to come from what's, you know, actually making that sense of space happen, which is the space itself.
There's this feeling though of whatever your processes are. I know you said earlier about some of the gear that once things are in a DAW, you don't tend to do much post-processing, but whether it's sonic choice, note choice, your mindset going into it, the sounds blend into this kind of world that seems very intentionally put together. Almost, I think that's why it sounded almost outdoors.
Yeah.
It almost has this, you're living within that Foley. The Foley's not a kind of heavy Foley release. There's also music in there, mm-hmm. chordal beds and guitar, but it's given enough kind of credit, if you like, sonically, that it seems like they're all in this space together. Works really well. I have a couple of specific questions for specific tracks,
sure.
Just personal curiosities, yeah. If you like. I wondered if you could remember what the echo was on the opening track, Evening Wind. It's got this lovely kind of warble and grit in a similar way that how certain notes catch in the track Says by Nils Fram, that there's moments of odd notes that just catch a tape delay. I wondered if you could remember what that echo was. I was personally curious on that one.
I use a lot of different things, but I'm pretty sure that is actually the auto BIM.
Okay.
Which is that little green digital delay box, you know, the BIM, the BAM, the boom.
Yeah.
Those are great little boxes. But the auto BIM, for being a digital delay, it gives you modulation capabilities, which definitely push it in a tapey vibe.
Yeah.
Plus, with a little bit of that lo-fi digital aspect to it, it can definitely sound tapey, and I'm pretty sure that's what you're hearing on that track.
We spoke about stereo image as well, and again, the next track, Stars on the Water, has a really lovely stereo image, and it feels like there's layers of almost half-speed tape, but then some kind of glassy digital alias, kind of lo-fi digital thing in the top end. I wondered what your approach, either for that track or generally, is to mixing mediums, because they're not the easiest things to get to sit. Something tape, something very digital, but they blend really well.
I actually I think that was one of the first tracks I recorded, and that was my approach really was to try to marry digital, which in that case was the Digitone FM synth, and use something super glassy, super digital, and record it to tape and play it at half speed and do other tape techniques so that you're getting this super sharp source material, but then you're doing all these things to round it out and like soften it up so that you still get something that cuts through but is round at the same time. That was kind of the idea.
And then again, around a specific track, but a general kind of question around the track centering, it feels like an old dusty fond memory on a Polaroid you've just pulled out of the basement or something like that. Everything on there feels like a kind of warped sample almost, but I'm imagining it's not, and the chord tone is something you've synthesized yourself, and there's guitar on there that I imagine you've played. Have you any general tips on trying to get this sonic character of, again, it's this idea of space, an old memory, a kind of Polaroid in audio, if you like? What's your approach generally to try and get, is it always just get it onto tape? Is it as simple as that?
Pretty much. I mean, this doesn't really relate to that, but that guitar was like, is my dad's guitar from the 60s, like an old Harmony, and it just, it like has that sound out of the box. So that was pretty easy to accomplish. And there's a one loop that's recorded the tape, and then another loop recorded the tape, played down, pitched down an octave, I guess, half speed. But that whole thing is another approach that I like to work with, where I'm just recording a bunch of tape loops. And in this case, they were, most of them were synced. A lot of times they'll be asynchronous. But, and when I say recording tape loops, I don't necessarily mean like Randall, like Amulets, where he's like actually cutting a piece of tape and either splicing it around something or putting it in a cassette. Literally what I'll do is I'll take something like one of these Marantz three head decks, or the Ur 4400, which is another three head deck, where you can monitor the tape as you're recording. And I'll just record through that. And occasionally I'll use a piece of tape that I have actually crumpled up a little bit, you know, unspool it from the cassette, crumple it up a little bit, spool it back, which is gonna give you, you know, a crunchy tape sound, obviously. And just record it through that into the DAW or into the 301. And it just, it sounds like a tape loop, because it literally, it is a tape loop. It's just not technically a tape loop.
Well, I'd like to wrap it up there, folks. It's been a great show. Before we go into the last little bits of the show, and just to say that the music underneath the podcast today is the album Stillness that we've talked about earlier in the show. I'll have all the links to Scott's material, and especially keep a look out for that video. It is just absolutely beautiful and worth a look at. So on that note, Ben, I think we'll wind it up.
Yeah, do go look at the Mellow Man link in the show notes. That fit.
Yes. The funky Mellow
it's
Man.
It's amazing.
Just get your flares on.
Yeah. And it's a good point to say that if we've mentioned anything that isn't in the show notes, just send us a message somewhere and we'll be happy to point you in the right direction. And I'd like to give a shout out to our connections over in Seattle. We've got Tim Held's Podular Modcast, Waveform Magazine by Ellison, Patchworks, which is still shipping. Most of the modular shops around there, the cool little shops around the world, are still shipping and running. Of course, you can't go in and play with the stuff, but it's good to support those and keep them going, certainly at the time we're in at the minute. And of course, Kyle and Robert's Source of Uncertainty Bookler podcast.
Yeah, and we release our show every month, so remember to subscribe on your favourite platform. And if you're over there, please give us a thumbs up. Can I just thank everybody who's reviewed us? We've had some amazing reviews, so big, big thank you to all those that do that and take the time out to actually do that. If you'd like more detailed show notes, then head over to our website at www.esotericmodulation.com.
And finally, find us on Instagram and Facebook, where you can keep up to date with what's happening. And Instagram's probably my favorite place to ping us a message. But yeah, Facebook's great for some of the groups out there. There's a nice ambient modular group that interact very nicely with the show, and some cool tape groups too.
I just want to say about Instagram that for some reason, I always miss the messages. I don't know what. I don't think it comes up on my phone well. So I do always get back to people. So if you do put a message on there, don't worry. I will actually get back to you when I actually find it.
Yeah, it's the message requests from people you don't follow. And I think they might disappear after a while on the app. Tips on Instagram on a postcard, please.
Yeah.
But yeah, that rounds us up. thanks again, Scott, for coming and joining us, for your lovely contributions to the world of the OM1, the modified Marantz tape delays, your music, and for being a guest and spending some time with us today. It's been great.
Yeah, it's been a real pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thanks a lot, Scott. Take it easy and see you all soon.
Bye.
See ya.
Bye.